Welcome to another episode of Techsplaining, where we don't keep track of the version numbers anymore.
Or episode
and
numbers.
We put out all of our podcasts in kind of Netflix fashion, where you can binge watch them, right? This is Stephanie Donahue, and I'm here with Rob Foster and Mark Rackley. And we're missing Brett today. He wasn't able to join us, but we've got some good stuff here. What's going on, guys?
Well, I've been in dev hell recently this week, so I'm it's kind of nice just to sit back and talk to you guys about some technology that's not related to my dev hell. Yeah, good stuff though. I mean, it's fun. I mean, I think I've had a great week. I've really had a lot of support. We talked a little bit about community support. And one of the things I was having trouble with, I ran across a blog from Michael Svensson, who's out of Norway. And I pinged him. We're Facebook friends. So I pinged him. I was like, hey, man, I saw this on your blog, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out that he was like, yeah. And I've actually expanded on that from that blog post. And here's a project on GitHub that I've been working on that kind of does the same thing, but it's kind of packaged up as a nice little package for you. And here's some documentation around it and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, it really just hit home again about just stressing on the, just keeping in contact with people in the community and kind of keeping a pulse on what's out there. And I didn't ask him for it. He totally ponied it up. And, you know, I got to say, Michael, man, you saved my butt this week. So thanks, hats off. And thanks so much for that. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. I've been writing code. I had to actually install Visual Studio again. It was awesome.
That's therapeutic for me though, as a developer by trade. That's, if I'm having a rough day, if I'm writing some code, that's a good way to kind of just zone out and let some stress go. So,
like, get into Visual Studio.
I can write real code. I'm not just JavaScript.
Yeah, I know you can. I think I've never seen your code. I'll tell you, somebody I've heard that writes crazy code is Stacey Draper. Now that dude, I think writes some crazy code.
Imagine,
with the personality.
Yeah. I imagine most things. He does a lot of things really crazy well at that. So,
yeah,
we need to have him on the show sometime and see what's up with him, and maybe have him relive some old stories and let us know. Entertain us for an hour or so.
Has come up before.
I think we've talked about this before. Yeah. I think the What Was Rob Black as a New MVP would not be a show that would ever go to air. It'd be fun for us. Yeah, it'd be fun for us.
Blackmail, so Mark, material.
What's been going on your way?
So Stephanie and I just got back from a week-long sales trip over in Arkansas and Oklahoma and Missouri. Just meeting some of our existing clients, some potential clients, and just trying to get a pulse on, you know, what the needs are out there. So just got back last night, not quite as late as Stephanie, but it was a really great week, a lot of great conversations. And there seems to be a common theme going on about what people are interested in, talking about, concerned about. So, but yeah, it was a really great week.
Yeah, did you guys fly or drive around?
Well, so Stephanie's in Ohio, so she flew down to where I'm at. I live in Arkansas, so I was the chauffeur for the week. It was really her show, and I was the sidekick all week. So I'm used to that.
You didn't have to tell me that.
Sales is my happy place. I like to go out and talk to people.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, what were your customers? I mean, what were they really seeing as? Because I'm sure you saw common trends and common kind of, asks. It seems like people in the certain markets or whatever have a similar kind of. They're having similar issues. So, what trends were you guys seeing in across your customers?
Lots of conversations on Teams. So that seems to be on the horizon for 2019 for a ton of customers. But really most of the conversation was around user adoption. I think we've gotten to a place where a lot of folks have moved to the cloud in one form or another. Exchange is up and running. They've got their intranets kind of moving forward. And now they're going, okay, what's next? Are we doing file share migrations? Where do those files go? We're doing a lot of talking about how to expand on the existing intranet, and just in general, it's just like, gosh, there's so much stuff to learn. What are we missing? What should we be doing, right? And I think everyone's just in this place where they're desperate to learn. We had one customer who said, you know, I used to hear from Microsoft all the time and we did these evergreen meetings and, you know, we don't get to do those anymore. And how do I keep up? So, you know, I think it's been the same conversation that we've had for a while with customers, but we're kind of moving it forward. It's not just how do I get to the cloud? It's what do I do now that I'm there? But we were a little bit on repeat. I mean, you know, a couple of the stories we felt like were very similar across our different customers.
Well, what are people finding once they get to the cloud? And I guess what issues are they encountering with user adoption? And how are they, I guess, planning to move past that, right? And really get their users into Teams and into SharePoint and all of the goodies that are involved there.
Oh, I don't know. Gosh, in general, I guess
that's probably what they're paying you for, right?
Yeah. there's a lot of doubters, right? Still, I think that sometimes the bottleneck is a little bit on IT, and there's this, it kind of fights each other. The IT department really wants to keep things locked down and secured and controlled. And at the same time, you've got this two different sets of people. You've got one set of people of the end users that are anxious to get their hands on literally everything and they want to spin it up and they want to do good things. And then you've got this other set who, like, you know, you can't even get them to respond to an email, right? They want to drop by your office still. So I think that's a lot of where the challenges are. You got to stay ahead of the people that are anxious to get moving on all these new technologies and protect them and make sure they don't do anything to, you know, put your intellectual property at risk, and balance that with a different generation of people that have a lot of knowledge, but aren't necessarily buying into the tools. And I think having challenges come at you from both of those angles it's really a lot. And I think the general feeling is, you know, no matter how much staff you have, it's never enough, and it has to come down to priorities. So that's a lot of what we do, is help. What are the priorities? What can be achieved easily? I know everyone hates the term, but the low hanging fruit, how do you knock that out? And then how do you move forward and get to the next thing and set reasonable expectations with the people who want everything right away?
How are they handling things like, I guess the more of the, once you drop this stuff out into your environment, right? You can, you know, let's just use Teams as an example. Anybody can create a team. They can make it public or private or whatever. And then if you have, let's just say, 1,000 people doing that, how do you, I guess, cut down on the proliferation of Teams? Because that seems to be something we're struggling with as we adopt is, you know, we've got all these teams out there. Now what? I mean, how do you really govern that? And how do you, I mean, are they thinking in those terms, or are they just really trying to launch it as a service?
Oh, the gut reaction is to shut that down. They are shutting it down. The PowerShell command you can run that limits who can create a team, that's the first thing everyone does. That ability to just run free and create what you need is definitely not happening. So they're not against it, right? I think the groups we talk to are like, that sounds great, but how do we protect it before they get out there? And so they're in the place right now where they're definitely open to making that a possibility, but they want to have control over it first before it runs away from them. Like you said, you have all these teams and sites and planner and all that stuff, all that sprawl. And I think the approach, at least, you know, we work a lot in the mid-market, and the mid-market's approach is, lock it down. I need to learn about it. What configuration do I need to put in place to help me control all of this? And so the process becomes, I'm going to set up a form where people can request what they need. And then it comes into me, and I can vet it as an IT person, and I can train the person who wants to be managing that stuff. And I know kind of who's working on what, so that I can help them through it in a manageable pace. And that seems to be the approach most are taking right now.
Yeah, that's something that absolutely will not scale with what we're doing, right? Because we've got, I think we've got I checked a couple days ago, and I think we've got 99,000 people on Teams now.
Wow.
And, you know, so you just can't have 100,000 people sending requests into one or two people, or, you know, a team of people trying to create Teams. And one of the things that we're finding out is that really does create a barrier And puts a lot of friction in the process. And what we found is that the more friction you have in your process, the more out somebody's going to go out and just download an app on their phone, right? Because I can go to the App Store on Apple and I can download anything and I can start collaborating with anybody. You know, it could be Slack or it could be something else. And the more friction we introduce, the more people, what we're finding is that the more likely people are out to do that, which could introduce a lot of risk to my company or our people and our customers. And so we're kind of on the opposite side of that, in that we want to do something like that. There's not really a way to lock it down unless you do what you're doing, right? And we want to do something like that, but we kind of just have to let we would rather provide a frictionless process for letting people get to the tools that they need. And then if we see something that's questionable or whatever, whether it's through e-discovery or it's through just kind of looking and at the teams and applying life cycle policies and things like that, we can govern it on the back end.
Now, have you set up any notifications or anything for when a team is created, or you really have no clue unless you do some sort of audit?
We have to actually go out and do an audit because right now there's about 40,000 teams that we've got created in our org.
Do you force users to go through any sort of training? I mean, do you do anything at all to make sure they don't do something stupid?
Nope. We do training sessions regularly. So if you want to, if we've got new people or whatever, we run them through the interface and talk about public versus private teams and where's the data stored and how do you get to the SharePoint backend and things like that? How do you add members? How do you manage the team? But nothing in terms of, and I've probably trained 30,000 people on that. So it is quite diverse, but there's no like formal, hey, you must go to this class before you can use Teams. It's, hey, you become an employee here. You have access to Teams just like you have access to OneDrive. It's just part of the experience when you get your laptop.
I think that speaks to the tool being easy to use. If it can be rolled out in mass and it's actually being used based on the number of teams you guys have in the environment, clearly it's in use. Now, I can't remember if we've talked about this yet, but do you have the archive policies on yet?
Not yet.
Clean things up? Yeah.
Not yet.
So that's probably next, right? That's like, okay, what happens when someone, because I had a customer actually make this comparison the other day, and I thought this was great. He said, well, Teams are kind of like an Apple Watch because it's the thing that everybody wants, right? It's the new tool. It's cool. Everybody loves it. But he's like, when I ask them what they're going to do with it, they don't know. Mm. They haven't figured that out yet. They just know it's cool and they want it. And they really don't know what it does yet. He's like, that's the kind of the gist that, you know, the idea that he thinks that Teams is just this, you know, big flashy thing and that there's not enough understanding of what to do with it. And, you know, what we argued was this tool is actually pretty user-friendly and people get in there and they demo back to us. It's not like the older legacy technology is where you need a tremendous amount of training in order to do anything with it. And it is a different world than it used to be, but I thought that was an interesting comparison because what you guys have going now is that, hey, what's my neighbor doing? And that's pretty cool. And I kind of want in too, which is exactly what you're looking for. Right.
Well, I mean, we've got a lot of millennials, right? And we've got a lot of Gen Zers that are actually entering the workforce right now.
I'm sorry.
No, but they get it, right? You don't have to train them. They know how to use it. And there's not, well, I mean, and like my kids, I don't know if you guys saw my post on Facebook yesterday, but my youngest, my oldest has been using Teams for years in school. And my youngest, I got an app request from him because I have to, you know, approve everything he installs on his phone, but he wanted to install Microsoft Teams because he had to do homework through it, right? And so my kids are actually using it to communicate with their class, communicate with their teachers, and I mean they're just going to know how to use this stuff when they get into the workforce. And we're not that far out from my oldest being, you know, employment ready. We're probably 6 years, 7 years, right, from him entering the workforce, and that's just not a lot of time. I mean. We've been using Teams for almost that long, you know? So, I mean, it's not that much and they know how to use it. So we're finding a lot of the training that has to come is with the older set, right? It's people that are about our age or even older, like the people that are just above.
Speak for yourself, Rob. We're not old.
Well, the people that are just above our age, so say 7 to 10 years older and above, right? So people that are in their
mid-30s,
late 40s to early 50s, right? They don't get things like Giphy, right? They don't understand it. They don't see a use for it. But you turn that crap off, and then like everybody else below that age group really just freaks out because they're like, oh, I need to show a picture of a cat drinking a cup of coffee or whatever. But it's kind of like the emojis, right? I mean, it's we all use emojis no matter what, you know, and Giphy's kind of that new thing that the people that are right kind of ahead of us in their career and age and things like that, just they don't understand it. But everybody else kind of from our age and below, it's just part of your everyday life, right? I use Giphy in Facebook all the time. I use it in text messages. Yeah, I do. but you know, so I mean, I think there's things in terms of training that's not only here's the tool, but there's also a lot of cultural things too that you have to boundaries on the. And I'm not saying anything bad about the older set or whatever, but there's just a lot of cultural boundaries that they're just not going to get. They're not going to understand.
With the younger people coming in, you know, you've got to make sure you're very clear with them that, hey, you guys are so social and you know how to use all this stuff, but there's a lot of stuff you should not be sharing. There's a lot of confidential information out there. There's a lot of, you've got to be as wise as these guys that are 70 years older than us. And because we've made it much easier for them to screw up and do stupid things. I mean, so how do you balance that?
I think it depends on the context, right? So, it really depends on the context and of where things are being shared, right? So if you have a team that you're doing all project work, you know, I find that people share mostly project related information. They talk about the what's going on with the client. They talk about with the documents they're trying to create. You know, whereas if you have a team called, I don't know, Dank Memes or something like that, you know, that's a little more social, right? it really depends on the context of where things are being shared, I think. And I think people are conscious enough to realize that I do this here, but I don't do that here.
Right? Well, and they're also conscious to never send an email to everybody in the organization.
Well, I and then reply all, right?
Right, and then reply all. I remember my very first job, actually it was my second job out of college, was at a semiconductor company in Austin, Texas. And I'd been there about a year. And there was this new guy, his first day on the job, he sent out an email to his friend. And instead of putting in the subject line, all of it, he put in the to line, all of it. And the message was about this really attractive girl he saw getting out of his car and how much he loved working there because of the attractive women there. And that went to everybody in the organization on his very first day of work.
Well, that's a good way to get your name out there.
And he was probably never forgotten, but I remember that story, all these years later. It's just that easy to do things you don't intend, even though you know better.
Well, I mean, I've also, changed the name of everybody in a database table to last name to Smith, right? So, I mean, I forgot a where clause in an update statement. So. Fun times. I was much younger. I was probably 23 years old, just to get that out there. But, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that's kind of put me in the place where I'm at now and having to write a lot of this code is around teams. And what I'm finding is that there's a lot of things that you have to do on the back end around this management stuff, right? There's things that are coming. They showed a lot of things at Microsoft Ignite that are essentially just vaporware. And when was Ignite? Was it in September?
Wasn't it? Yeah, it was because September. It's October. It's in November next year.
Or maybe it was in June. Maybe it was in June. It was sometime in the summer. But anyway, we're about 7 months out from Ignite. And many of the things that they showed there that we were really banking on they're just not in the tenant yet. They, you know, Teams doesn't do it. So things like external access policies, things like conditional access policies that actually work. So a lot of the data classification stuff, a lot of that stuff they showed is just not there. So what we're having to do is write a lot of code on top of Teams to actually do a lot of this stuff for us. And what I've done is I've developed a set. It looks like it's going to be a set of Azure functions that are available for me to run against my tenant. And then in combination with a couple Azure web jobs that do some automation stuff. And an example of one of the things I need to do is we want to be able to provide external access to people. So allowing guests into your team. Now, that's great, except that it's either on by default for all your teams or it's off by default for all of your teams. So what we want to do is we want to be able to provide the ability to turn it off for all of our teams, but only turn it on for selected approved teams. So if you might be a team that you know, maybe you're just doing some internal work, leave it off for those people by default. But if you need to actually engage with clients or customers or whatever, be able to turn it on only for those people where it's needed to really reduce the risk of data exfiltration and, you know, all that stuff. So what I'm having to do is I'm having to actually create a job that runs basically every hour. And it monitors for new teams that are out there. And so anytime a new team comes on board that shows up in the system, it by default, external sharing will be on. It just goes out and turns that off. Now, there's obviously some reporting things I have to do. I have to go into the team to say, in that hour time span, did they add somebody external? Right. and I have to report back on that and stuff like that. But, you know, it's a lot of the things around Teams that we're doing now that we're actually engaging and we really have to implement it to, you know, across the organization. There's a lot of back-end jobs that I'm having to write with that. And that was some of the things that Michael helped with kind of the approach there. But yeah, I mean, for us, I mean, it really is getting it launched and getting it adopted was fairly seamless. People love it. They want it. They need it. Now managing it and really doing some enterprise level stuff and governance and a lot of that is starting to become challenging in that there's a lot of code there's a lot of things that are coming. Haven't seen them yet, but there's a lot of code you've got to write until those pieces come.
Right.
You know,
well, and to that, they've really given us some great tools to help write functionality for Teams. And I think that, you know, a lot of sessions at conferences are starting to really highlight that stuff. There's a lot of great examples being built. And so I mean, it's crazy to me how much Microsoft is all in on Teams and everything that they're doing with it. I mean, it's bigger than anything I've ever seen for them, I think. I really do.
Well, it goes back to that conversation. We were talking a little bit before we hit record. It goes back to that conversation I was having with Bill Baer, and we talked about at Ignite and a lot of this was used to SharePoint was the destination, right? That was where you went to go get your collaboration stuff done or your intranet. It seems to be that SharePoint now is more of a service and Teams is the destination. Right. And now with Skype rolling in, with the capabilities of Skype rolling into Teams, that's even becoming more true, right? Because Skype is going to be, or Teams is going to not only be your collaboration client, it's going to be your instant messaging client as well. So I think, yeah. I think there's big things to come. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think it's going to be bigger and better than ever. It's never going to be smaller than it is right now, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's right now it's just taking off. I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I think that's also creating a lot of the uncertainty that we're seeing and a lot of hesitation we're seeing because then people realize how big it could be and they want to make sure they don't, you know, I think people learned going back to SharePoint in the old days, I think they learned from their past that you can't, if you turn SharePoint loose and let people do what they want to do, you've got an enormous mess that you've got to clean up and it just becomes unfunctional, right? Because on-prem SharePoint, after a few years, it was just crippling slow. It didn't work well anymore, and people remember that. It's seared into their memory. So now they see this Teams thing, and they're having flashbacks to how that went because they didn't control it, because they did let people go free range. So that's causing people to really, you know, see what we're seeing with, you know, turning off the ability to create those teams and want to approach it more cautiously.
Well, the good thing, and I think where they've really hit the ball out of the park, whether this was by accident or by design, I think it was more possibly by accident, is they do make the data available, right? So the things I'm trying to do, it's at least possible to do, right? So and the way they do that is they make it available through the Microsoft Graph. And being able to get to the data is head and shoulders above – even though Teams doesn't do it, it gives you so much more of an advantage to be able to just get to the data and then react based off of that, whether it's through, in my case, a web job and some Azure functions, or it could be a PowerShell script or whatever. Having the ability to do that is, you know, you're 99% there if you've got the data, if you can get to the data.
Right.
And getting to the data, I found this as well, that, and we talked about this, that there's a Microsoft Graph SDK. And I would encourage people to go out there and check it out. It's a NuGet package that you can add to your Visual Studio project. And it basically allows you to communicate with the graph in a very seamless way. And it gives you objects back. So if you're wanting to get groups for your teams, or you want to get users or documents or whatever, it's a very seamless way to actually go out there and get that stuff. And it's I have to say, very well done. I mean, I think Microsoft put it out. You know, I was blown away. I haven't seen anything that I've needed it to do that it doesn't do.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Stephanie can add some information about that to the show notes. So,
hey, I started into the show notes, guys. You should be excited. I've got at least 2 shows done.
Oh, nice. Fantastic.
Maybe 3.
Well, Mark, I know you're a dev, though. Have you played with the Graph SDK?
Because I have. I've done some projects where I've just included it. And, you know, like the ability to make, a get and a post, it's just all structured there for you. I mean, it takes... Literally, you could fire up a client web part in SharePoint or Teams that calls into the graph and be done in 10 to 15 minutes and deployed as an app in Teams. I mean, it's really, really seamless. It's one of those things that are so easy to do, you almost feel like you really didn't do anything. It's like, oh, it just works. I can't even really brag about it, right? It just worked. How can I, you know, I'll take credit for it, but I can't really brag about it.
Yeah. It kind of makes calling into SharePoint, because I'm both calling into when I'm doing things like, I guess for the graph stuff, sort of with the team stuff, when you turn on external sharing or turn it off, you also have to do that at the SharePoint side as well. So, you know, not only at the group, but at the SharePoint side, because it's 2 separate entities. It kind of makes me mad about it's not difficult, but just how many more extra steps it takes to connect to SharePoint, because you've got to have your X509 certificate set up. You've got to have your, you know, all the stuff in your manifest in the ADAL, a service principal, you know, all of that stuff has to be set up and working just right before you can even talk to SharePoint. with the graph, you basically need an app ID, you need an app secret, and you need to have permissions granted to the ADAL web app, and you're off to the races.
Yeah, and it's even easier than that if you're using the SharePoint framework and doing a client web part. All you have to do is write the code, and then you basically, within your manifest of your project, you say what permissions you need to the graph. And then when you go to deploy the application, it requests those permissions from your tenant. And then you go to your tenant to your pending requests, and you grant permissions from the tenant itself, and it works.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just really easy.
So the admins have to go in there and give admin consent to that thing once you deploy it?
Only the first time. If I write a client web part that does request calendar read permissions, the first time that app is deployed, you have to go into your tenant and grant access to the calendar read function to that app. However, then, if you go and write an application in my tenant that needs the calendar read all permission, that permission is granted for anybody who writes an application from that point out. So you don't have to re-grant that or re-approve that permission every time a new application is deployed.
Is that good or bad?
It's by design. Because I asked the question, it is by design.
Right. Because I could see that being, while easy, very dangerous.
It's by design. I'll say
that. Right.
Because I actually tried to report it. I tried to report it as a bug. I'm like, guys, I just found this out. I'm like, oh, no, that's by design. I'm like, okay.
All right. Well.
So, Mark, what did you actually build?
So what I ended up building is I have my boss. She has multiple tenants where she has to track her calendars, and people are always sending her meeting requests based upon availability on calendar, and it drives her up a wall. And so I created this client web part in the SharePoint framework that will call into the graph, and it will, for everybody who exists within your team, the current team that the app is deployed to, it gets all the people from that group. And then it makes another call to the graph to go and get all of their free meeting times for the people in the group. And then it displays on the screen what are the free meeting times for everybody in the group that match. So it will only show those times for everybody in the group that has time to meet. And then I'm integrating that with the other tenant as well, making the same call for the other tenant and then combining the two so that you can see the free time for everybody based upon both tenants that they're part of. So you can schedule meetings. And no one
sounds really. Pretty handy.
It does sound pretty handy.
Like something your boss would really like.
I love it.
Yeah. She still hasn't thanked me for it, but.
She pays you. That's enough.
Okay. Yeah. Touche.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that, yeah, like I said, I believe that we've got a good solution around this. I mean, we're probably not the only ones in the world doing it. Apparently not, since there's some functions and things like that that Michael was working on. But I think it is good. I just don't want it to be too customized, right? I don't want to get into the where we have the Rob's instance of Teams or whatever, and you've got all these services baked into the back end. Ideally, I would like to have that replaced with things like policies that are applied and things like that. And until those come live, which again, not heard anything since Ignite, that's really kind of the only option there.
There are some policies that I ran into in our admin area for Teams and SharePoint. So it looks to me like there's messaging policies and like conferencing policies. So some stuff around that. But I haven't had a whole lot of chance to dig in there and see exactly how specific you can get with it. Pretty sure like the external sharing stuff, things like that, I haven't seen anything around that. We actually had a customer who turned off external sharing, but then created a whitelist for domains. Mm-hmm. And then when they did that, they did that for the messaging piece. They just did the blanket, whitelist at the top level. And what they realized was that while it worked perfectly for messaging, when they opened things up to do the conferencing, that they could not take advantage of inviting external people to their conferencing because they had turned off, so that actually applies to both sides of the house there at that level. So then they removed the whitelist to open things back up and it still didn't work. And as it turns out, when they went into their Skype settings, there was something that had flipped in terms of the way the setting worked, and they actually had to change it in Skype, even though they had already cleared their whitelist in Teams. So you also have to watch kind of some of that interoperability between those two. If you had one configured, now you're setting up Teams, there's a little bit of glitchiness there between getting Skype updated again once you've made a change in Teams. So we actually had to submit that one into Microsoft. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and you're working on some multi-geo stuff too with Teams, aren't you?
Rob, oh, yes.
Out before the call?
Oh, yes.
Care to share?
Multi-geo. Well, it's kind of interesting, right? I don't believe that Teams is multi-geo compatible right now, right? So you can, like, when you turn on multi-geo, you add a satellite tenant to your home tenant. So let's just say your home tenant's in North America, you add a satellite tenant to Canada or to Europe, Western Europe, or whatever. What happens is that in Azure Active Directory, you have to set up a field called the primary data location, PD. You'll hear me say PDL, but it's the primary data location. And that basically says when you spin up your OneDrive account or you spin up anything else that's multi-geo compatible, it says, hey, Rob's in North America. Whatever he's trying to do, do it in that North American tenant. To where if Mark might be, you know, based in Amsterdam or whatever, his would be in Western Europe. To where, you know, if you spun up a OneDrive, your OneDrive, it's gonna provision in Western Europe. Now, that flows into as you start creating groups, as you start creating SharePoint sites and things like that. All of that location of things is hinging where it creates the root of these things is all hinging on your PDL, on your primary data location, which could be what you want, but there could have some impacts to how you collaborate across borders, right? So let's just say that, you know, Stephanie's in Canada. We go on an engagement together. We start working. She spins up a Microsoft team. Well, if her primary data location's in Canada, then all of the things that I load in there, right? So if I add files, the SharePoint site's going to be in Canada. If we have conversations, that stuff's going to be, wherever it may be. So I have to be really careful where if there's potential data sovereignty rules or laws that I have to comply by, I might not be legally allowed to upload a file to that team because it's in Canada. It's not in the US, right? And or whatever. So it's really more prevalent in Europe. I mean, the North Americans are a little different. Canada is a little funny about where things can be, and things like that. So one of the things that we've been trying to determine is where are all of these things located? Because in teams, when you provision a team, that could you all kinds of things get created. So things like you get messages, images, you got files, voicemails, recordings, calendar meetings, contacts, telemetry, and things like that. So there's all kinds of different things that get created. And depending on where you are, those things could remain in your home tenant, right? So, or they could go to your satellite tenant where your PDL is located. So it gets kind of funny. And what we're waiting on for teams before we can say Microsoft, before they can certify teams as multi-geo ready, all of those services have to be able to go into your primary data location, right? Because otherwise, what's going to happen is that some things are going to go to primary data location, some things are going to stay in the home tenant. So in our example, our home tenant was in North America. So things like, I think things like your messages or images you upload or recordings, all of that stuff is going to stay in your home tenant. So when you do a recording of a Teams call, that actually gets loaded into Stream, which is hosted in your home tenant. A lot of those things, you know, just get to stay there. Now, things like files, things like calendar meetings, contacts that are specific to you, right, as a user, that actually goes to your primary data location. So wherever you are, those things get saved there. So as you're traversing through Teams and you're saving things and you're adding things, it could go to one of many different locations.
Well, how are you controlling that? How are you educating people on that? I mean, how do you even begin?
Well, once you turn on, there's nothing really to educate, right? Once you turn on multi-geo, it starts doing it automatically.
Well, I'm just saying, you create a new team. I'm in Malaysia, and I create a new team because mm-hmm. in my primary location is Malaysia, and I create a team called Project X. Well, the people in the U.S. have, how are they supposed to know that anything they're uploading is not being stored in the U.S. tenant?
They don't know. There's no way, because there's nothing inside of Teams that tells you this is in the Malaysian tenant. As I give you the two thumbs up on the video cam.
It's very nice.
Yeah. So they're working on it. But these things happen. As soon as you launch the first instance of a multi-geo tenant, this stuff is going to start happening. And you just need to be cautious of that. And the example we see most is that you're working on a multinational engagement. The team gets spun up in one country, and then people from another country start coming in and adding content to that or whatever. There's really no way for them to know that this is in whatever geo that it was created in.
Could you? Okay, I'm a developer, so I'm putting my developer hat on for a second. So there's a PowerShell script that you can run that you can like prepend team names with a prefix if you want to, so that you can help control the names of your teams. Mm-hmm. Could that PowerShell script somehow recognize the home tenant of the person that created the team and then prepend the name of the team with the country that it was for? And then that way you know every team what country they're in, because that PowerShell script would set it for you?
It's possible. I would say that's very possible. I don't know how your users would like having that team renamed, right? So I don't know. I mean, obviously you would have to communicate that says, hey, this is going to rename a team based on the location it is. Ideally, I would like to see some interface inside of Teams or some button. You know how it says, like, you get the public or private little icon at the top of the Teams interface? I would like to see something there that says this is in whatever geo. You know, that would be easy enough.
I like my idea better. But
yeah, I mean, your idea is very it's very developer-y. Yeah, I mean, it's very developer-y.
So, okay, then fine. It's the name of the team with the flag for the country that it's hosted in next to the name of the team. How's that? Problem solved.
Are you up to speed on all your flags, Mark?
Well, so here's a funny thing.
Identify them.
Geographies are not a one-to-one mapping for a country, right? So Western Europe could cover a bunch of countries, right? It's really more at the data center level.
Shut up.
Just give me some text. Let me put a description in for my tenant and show that description. Okay. That's all I want.
Fine. I'll get behind that one.
The SharePoint URLs, if you go actually to the SharePoint site behind the scenes, they are reflective. So if you open up SharePoint in the browser behind a team, it's going to show that, and you're going to be able to tell by the URL that it's in another geography.
Okay.
That's assuming you name your satellite tenants appropriately. Southeast Asia or whatever. But you will be able to tell it from there by looking at the URL. Okay. I don't know how often users are going to do that, right? I mean, I would notice because, I do, but I don't know if the general bean counter that's out there adding Excel spreadsheets is going to notice that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's just some interesting things, right? And what they're doing is they're bringing these services more and more to where they are going to be more isolated to the satellite tenants wherever the site was created. So right now they're all, for the most part, only a few things travel with the user. It's really kind of user specific things. the group that the user created, the SharePoint site behind that, their contacts, their calendars, things like that. All of the other services, so things like Planner, right? Planner still goes to your home tenant. So what they're doing and in process of doing is making all of those other services that encompass Teams that are used by Teams multi-geo compatible or multi-geo aware. I guess they're multi-geo aware now. They're just not multi-geo doing it. Whatever you call it, I don't know what the word would be, but they're not. They're only in one geo.
Cool.
Yeah. Yay.
Yay. So, yay, teams.
Yeah. So, Stephanie, I don't know if you're on mute. You're on mute, but I mean, what are your? Do you have any thoughts before we close the show? I know we've been talking for almost an hour now.
Nope, I've been super quiet today, letting you guys kind of run with things. It's always good for me to learn a little more about what's going on the dev side of the world. Hopefully people are picking up some interesting tips from you. I think a lot of people might assume that there's nothing that they could do if they're in a situation like yours where you want to lock things down by team. They might just give up and say, I can't do external sharing. It's either on for everything or off for everything. So I think these are really good tips. Kind of give people some options. It's been good. Things to share with customers.
That's right. That's
right. We'll let your pain be our benefit. Thank you.
I'm happy for that. Happy for that. Well, if anybody has any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at info@techsplaining.net. And, you know, thanks for listening. And I hope you at least learned a little bit, little pieces of nuggets here and there. But I guess until next time, we will talk to you guys probably very soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.